What's up, you tarantula keeping, scorpion feeding, snake handling, frog freaks? This is another episode of the Exotic Pet Collective. I'm so happy you're here. We've got a great guest today. If you've been following the podcast for a while, or even just for a short while, I think it was only just a few episodes back, she was actually on the podcast briefly that I did live from Fear Not Tarantulas in Virginia Beach when we were doing the Tarantula Collective meetup and the Fear Not grand opening. It's Dr. Linda Rayor from Cornell University in the entomology department. Fascinating conversation. I really enjoyed talking to her. Learned a lot. She I don't know. It was a good conversation we had there at the grand opening, but it was a little crazy. It was very loud and people milling around the background. It was kind of hard to really, I don't know. It was a distracted conversation. And she agreed to come back on the podcast later on so that we could talk uninterrupted and get a lot more in depth. So, you know, we talked for, I don't know, it seemed like about 2 hours or so. And it was a very fun and interesting conversation. I really enjoyed talking to her. We had to cut it short, though. Probably could have gone on another hour, but my poor dog hurt her paw. So I don't know what she did, but she went out back, you know, to use the bathroom, do her thing, and she came back limping. And I was like, what's wrong with you? And I checked her paw, and the padding on the paw had, like, part of it kind of got torn, almost like how you have a hangnail, and you pull the hangnail, and it rips off part of your skin. That's kind of what it looked like on her paw. And she was definitely favoring it. So, you know, I cleaned it up with some hydrogen peroxide and, you know, did what first aid I could because it was, you know, it was like 11 o'clock at night. I don't know what she did, but I took her to the vet this morning and they said she probably just had a little bit of loose skin and maybe was digging in the dirt or scratched at the door or something and it got caught. And when she pulled her paw away, it kind of ripped it. But there was no infection, nothing bad. I mean, they're not even going to bandage it. They were just like, we don't need to give her antibiotics. Just keep it clean and dry. And she'll be fine. It'll callus back up. She'll be good to go. So nothing to worry about, but I did have to take her to the vet because, I don't know, I was worried about her. She's my dog, and she's a sweetheart, and she was limping, and it was obviously very sensitive because I would touch it. She'd yelp. So, you know, I wanted to make sure everything was cool. There was no infection, and also to figure out what the heck happened because I was like, how did you hurt your paw like this? But she's all good. I need to go pick her up right now. She's at the vet. But I just wanted to, you know, try something new and introduce this podcast a little bit different. Dr. Rayor is very intelligent and very friendly, and I really enjoyed having this conversation with her. And I think you guys are going to enjoy listening to it as well. So before we jump into the podcast, I want to thank the sponsor of today's video. And our first sponsor today is no stranger to the podcast, and that is our friends over at Arthropod Ambassadors. Now, their aim is to support others interested in bugs and the well-being of arthropods around the world. They're working on spreading education with ResinArt, the mobile bug zoo, and informational YouTube videos, as well as a recent new line of stickers and pins. From compost-enhancing roly-polies to alien-like top predator mantises, arthropods come in all shapes and sizes and are waiting to teach us more about the Earth that we all have in common. So if you're looking for a mantis, jumping spiders, isopods, roaches, or assassin bugs, head on over to arthropodambassadors.com and check out what species they have available. You can also find very helpful care videos for your pet mantis, scorpions, vingaroons, isopods, tarantulas, and other arthropods on their YouTube channel, also called Arthropod Ambassadors. You can also follow them on Instagram and Facebook and stay up to date with any new content or species that they may have available in the future. So a huge thanks to Arthropod Ambassadors for sponsoring this podcast. And if you want to learn more about them, I'll link the podcast that we did together at the end of this video or down below in the show notes. And our second sponsor today is none other than TarantulaCribs.com. If you're looking for high-end acrylic enclosures for your tarantulas, scorpions, isopods, or pretty much any invertebrate, then you need to head over to TarantulaCribs.com. They recently restocked their website, and they have some new products coming out in the very near future, like larger enclosures. So whether you're looking for an arboreal or terrestrial enclosure, they have a wide variety of sizes for any stage of your invert's life. I use them a lot for my tarantulas and true spiders, and they're my favorite enclosure by far. And if you use the code TCollective10 at checkout, you'll receive 10% off your entire order. Currently, they're only available to residents of the United States, but they are working on international shipping, so hopefully that'll be available soon. So thank you so much, Tarantula Cribs, for supporting this podcast and for all the sponsors today. You guys are awesome, and you're integral in keeping this podcast up and running. So Thank you so much for your support. So a huge thanks to today's sponsors. I couldn't be doing this podcast without you guys, because really there's just no way to monetize a podcast this size other than having sponsors like you guys. So I definitely appreciate your support. It's amazing. Not just the sponsors, but all you guys that are listening. It's great having you. It's just fun. I enjoy doing these podcasts. Now, I mean, even if you guys weren't listening, I would probably still do the podcast just because I get to talk to interesting people about spiders and exotic pets and stuff like that. And I would just pretend that people were listening. But the audience has been growing every week. It's really exciting. I wish my personal life wasn't so crazy right now, because then I would be able to consistently upload every week. But as it is right now, we're doing about every other week, which I know is not ideal, but until things calm down in my personal life or I get an assistant or something, which is very rare, very unlikely to happen, we'll probably have to keep it at every other week for the foreseeable future, but hopefully that will change soon. But enough of me rambling and talking. Let's jump right into this conversation from the Department of Entomology at Cornell University. Please welcome to the show, Dr. Linda Rayor. Hello, Linda. How are you today?
I'm just fine. Delighted to talk with you.
Yeah, I'm very excited to have you here. We talked a little bit beforehand. We actually spoke initially at the Virginia Beach Fear Not Tarantulas grand opening. And maybe you could help clear this up for me, just because I sometimes get a little confused with all of the different different classifications or names. Like you're a faculty with the Department of Entomology. So what's exactly is the difference between a biologist, an entomologist, and an arachnologist?
Oh, that's interesting. So biology is a huge field that encompasses lots and lots of different topics, everywhere from molecular biology to behavior to all sorts of things. I am in the Department of Entomology, which is specifically the study of insects and arthropods more generally.
Okay.
I myself am an arachnologist, so really I'm interested in is the behavior of spiders, specifically their social behavior. But I'm also interested in amblypygids, and I just love tarantulas, so I've got a lot of them, and am particularly interested in communal tarantulas that live together and what they're doing. So that's my general interest. Maybe this is a time to talk about what an arachnologist might study or something.
Yeah, that was actually going to be my next question. I'm curious, like exactly what it is that you study, but also how, like what is the path? Because I did a little research maybe years ago when I was like, I wonder how someone becomes an arachnologist. So I was like searching for universities that had an arachnology department or something. And pretty much they were all like, well, you study biology and then you specialize. Right. So what's the journey for someone to become an arachnologist? How does that work, and what exactly do they do?
So let me give the big picture is spiders are amazing. I think most of your audience knows that. And spiders are really interesting. And so biologists are studying spiders at a crazy number of different levels. And I would seriously consider right now to be the golden age of arachnology. At the last meetings, there were over 500 people from around the world who came to talk about their academic research on spiders. And so the big picture is spiders are awesome. They can be studied in terms of biological control of pest insects. They can be studied in terms of systematics and relationships. They can be studied in terms of how do different venoms work and how might these be turned into drugs to help human health. And a lot of people, I don't know that a lot of people are studying this, but there is enormous interest in this right now. Different people are looking at the molecular biology of silk and how silk might be transformed into, almost weightless parachutes that don't tear because they're so strong, or they might be used like Kevlar vests, but not be hot and sweaty and heavy. in the military or for police. So there's lots of interest in spiders. There's lots of interest in their ecology and how they are top predators in many different systems. Same thing with, I study the behavioral ecology of spiders. And so there are a lot of interest by different people in different people interested in the biology and behavior of spiders. One of the biggest areas of study in spiders is basically how they do it, because spider sex is so incredibly weird with the indirect fertilization, yeah, where males are laying packets of sperm, putting it into another organ, and then introducing that organ into the female. And because the female has two different sides and he has two different palps, you can do experiments on, you know, who's fertilizing her first or this sort of thing by closing off one side of the female or nipping one of the male palps. So there's lots and lots of different work. One of the things that I wanted to mention is that in arachnology, over women are totally dominating spider behavior. There's great men who work in the area. Yeah. There are a lot of women. And especially if you study social behavior, this is not totally, but overwhelmingly women who study spider sociality. Who knew? Yeah. I mean, it's really kind of an odd thing. And in fact, I'm coming up. I'm president-elect of the American Arachnology Society. So in 2 years, I'll be the president. The president who just left the position was a woman. The president of the International Society of Arachnology was a woman, Yael Lubin. Yeah, and the last one was Greta Binford. So there are a lot of women studying spiders because they're awesome.
Well, you're the third person I've had so far on the podcast that is in like the scientific field related to tarantulas and other arachnids. And so far, all three of them have been female. So, I mean, I see what you're saying. What was your journey to become an arachnologist?
My journey is kind of an odd one. Basically, I grew up in Denver, Colorado. And although I must have seen spiders as a kid, I have no recollection at all. I wasn't scared of spiders, but I certainly was not interested in spiders at all. And I did my undergraduate degree in molecular biology at the University of Colorado Boulder. And it was so much not a fit for me. I don't like being in the lab all day doing chemistry, essentially. I like being outside studying animals and nature. And so for my PhD work, I moved to the University of Kansas, where I did a PhD on prairie dog social behavior and comparative work with other ground-dwelling squirrels like Colombian ground squirrels and 13-line ground squirrels and marmots. Okay, so I went this route, but I was very, very fortunate to take a class. Well, what really happened is I was walking around outside my first semester in Kansas. And what you need to understand is Colorado is really high. It's really dry. And I got to the University of Kansas and just went crazy. It was at the edge of the eastern deciduous forest, and it felt so lush. And I had this job walking around outside, and I was finding these huge jumping spiders. I was finding black and yellow garden spiders and going, oh my God, these are so cool. I was so excited by the spiders, and I was bringing them back to entomology graduate students and saying, man, look at this. What is this? And they were jerks with me. Uniformly, they were jerks with me and said, spiders are spiders. They're not insects and they don't matter. And I'm kind of, you've got to be kidding. Can you believe this? And I found this really cute guy, and turned out he was interested in spiders. And our first evening, we were keying out spiders. These are jumping spiders and black and yellow garden spiders. Okay. My spider biology students would have known this immediately, or, you know, in the first week, they would have learned this. But, you know, he pushed his glasses back and, oh my God, he was gorgeous. And we ended up doing research together to find out if we were scientifically compatible, and you met him, and he is still cute as the Dickens. I don't know if you call somebody who's six cute as the Dickens, but really handsome. And so both of us got interested in spiders kind of around each other. And so for me, spiders were just really interesting biology and fun times and romantic. This is my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Okay.
The thing is, I took a course, first year of grad school, I took a course on social insects. I had already gotten interested in spiders, and so I wrote a paper on social spiders and went, oh, man, I've got to study social spiders. In the third year of my doctoral dissertation studying prairie dogs, they all died. 1,500 animals died of Sylvatic plague, same thing as bubonic plague. And my other field site, they decided to shoot them out. And my claim to fame, or one of my many claims to fame, is that I had the highest plague antibody titer of anybody the CDC had seen at that point who was not sick. I had been getting vaccinations, and please get vaccinations. They help you live. And so I did not get plague, but it was really demoralizing. And at that point, I said, I am going to work on spiders. So for my postdoc, I worked on spiders, and it has been straight ahead for me. In a broader sense, how do you become an arachnologist? Well, you become an arachnologist by studying biology and taking all the biology classes, all the sciences you can as in high school. When you start college, there are two routes, and I'm going to talk two routes if you're willing to let me
matter
like this. The straight up academic route is you take as much science as you can take. And so you take biology, and I think as an arachnologist, you need to think about what you want to do with your life. Do you want to become an academic arachnologist? It's great. I've loved it, but it's not for everyone. If you're thinking about this route, think about what you actually want to do research on. I wanted to do behavior from the time I was a little kid. It was always going to be behavior, even if I made a bad choice as an undergraduate. Mm-hmm. And so, or do you really want to study aspects of molecular biology or systematics? You take courses on this, and then you say, these are the animals that I'm going to work with. If you just love spiders because spiders are just awesome and you want to learn more about them, there's a lot of different ways that you can learn about them. There's a number of different summer courses, generations of professional and non-professional arachnologists have taken courses at Highlands Biological Station on spiders. And this is offered every couple of years, where you learn how to identify spiders and how to, you know, look at them under the microscope and learn some basic biology around them. There's lots of summer courses that do things like this. There's courses intermittently in Costa Rica. I taught an adult week-long workshop through Cornell Adult University in January online, and I taught a week course for teens this summer online, and I'm sure I will be doing more of that. So there's lots of courses for the kind of in-between. You don't want to become, or you don't know if you want to become a professional arachnologist, but there's things that you can learn more about it. If you're just interested in spiders and think they're awesome, and you would be thrilled to be working at a pet store or something like that, my idea is you have as many pets as you can along the way. Study them in the field, study them in captivity. And she seems to be moving, and I'm going to try something if you're willing.
Okay.
This is a David Bowie huntsman who is guarding an egg sack. I don't know if you can see how awesomely adorable she is. And this is a really fast pain in the ass species.
Yeah, I have one in my collection.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I have studied a lot of huntsman spiders, and I've never seen one that built zigzagging running into their behavior, but that's what they do. But when they sit on egg sacs or often just sitting on leaves, you can get very, very close to photographing them.
Very cool.
And I need to say that although I hope I'll have the opportunity to show you other huntsmen in here, there is no way I would ever lift them out and show them to you out of their cage.
Oh, yeah. I would hope not.
They're fast.
So an arachnologist, is that like an official title? Like, do you get a degree in arachnology, or are you just like a biologist or entomologist that specializes in spiders and then are referred to as an arachnologist?
That's a good question. Offhand, I don't know any biology department who has a department of arachnology. My own degree, you know, my PhD is in behavioral ecology. My degree is in systematics and ecology with a specialty in behavioral ecology.
Okay.
Students who would come out of this department who have studied arachnology with me would have a degree in entomology. It depends on what department you're in, more so than anything. I don't know that there is any rule that says somebody who studies spiders in the field and who is interested in their behavior would not be an arachnologist because they don't have a formal degree in it. I think somebody who is interested in spiders is interested in arachnology, whether they can call themselves an arachnologist professionally or not. Okay.
Okay.
I think studying spiders is awesome no matter what level you're doing it with. A colleague of mine is going to have her 12-year-old coming into my lab for a couple of hours a week because she is crazy about spiders, and I am going to pay her in baby tarantulas. And
nice.
She is clearly interested in arachnology and has been going crazy with it for the last year. A year and a half.
They're getting paid in spiders. That's my kind of currency.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you've mentioned huntsman spiders a few different times. So now, is that like why does your research seem to focus on huntsman spiders? What is it about huntsman spiders that you find so fascinating, or what is it about their behavior that intrigues you?
You know, that's a good question, and I think I don't have a simple answer.
That's okay.
Here's my answer. When I started teaching spider biology, I started collecting tarantulas because they're big enough to show students the anatomy. And like probably everyone who listens to this, I went crazy for their diversity.
Yeah.
And at the time, I was really looking for a project. In 1996, I read a paper by Dave Roll and Leticia Aviles about social behavior in an Australian huntsman spider, Delana cancerides. And I read this paper and just went crazy. Went, oh my gosh, this is so interesting. I had done a postdoc on social or on colonial spiders in Mexico. I was looking for a system that I could work with of my own. And I read this paper and went, man, I've got to do it. And my husband had a sabbatic coming up, and he came to me and said, Linda, what would you think of going to Australia for 6 months? And I went, yes, I want to go to Australia. Absolutely. And so it took me 5 minutes of going, oh, this is wonderful. Absolutely, I'm into it. And then I said, honey, I have got to study these huntsman spiders. I just have to study these huntsmen. And so I'll commute to you. Turns out the researcher, Jochen Zeil, that he was going to work with, and Dave Roll were about 100 meters apart between buildings. Mm-hmm. And so we both went to the Australian National University, and I started studying these huntsman spiders. I had thought that these spiders would be very similar to the other huntsman spiders, and they turned out to be crazily different. And so I've spent the last 20 years studying their behavior. So I had already liked huntsmen, but as soon as I started studying the social one in Australia, I was enchanted. They're big, they're beautiful, they're diverse. But the questions that I was asking, I didn't know whether I was working with a huntsman that was radically different than all of the other huntsmen. It was the only social one known at that point, or whether they were doing pretty normal huntsman stuff. They were just staying in groups longer than other huntsman spiders. It turned out that no one really knew. Anybody who lives in areas with huntsmen are familiar mm-hmm. with them. They're big spiders. They're really big spiders. They're beautiful. They're diverse. They come in houses. There is no person in Australia who hasn't had a story of a big huntsman coming into their car or their bedroom or something like this.
Okay.
So everybody was familiar with them, but even arachnologists didn't seem to know that much about their behavior.
Now, are you, to interrupt real quick, are you talking about like a bunch of different species of huntsmen that are in Australia, or is it one specific species that you're referring to? I thought I offended you when you were walking away.
No, not at all. So can you see
these guys? Goodness, yeah.
So this is a relatively small group. This is an outbred species, and these guys are relatively inbred because I was last collecting in Australia in 2017.
Okay.
And I just want to emphasize that I was legally collecting in Australia in 2017.
I mean, looks like there's almost 20 huntsman spiders in that enclosure. That just me quickly counting. I can't tell what's a spider and what's a molt, but.
On that order. And one of the interesting things about these spiders is that they will live together for a year until they reach sexual maturity. At that point, they will disperse. And retreats are very rare for this species. And so at that point, when mom dies, because she's about 2.5 years old, when mom dies, all hell breaks loose. And the older girls will start attacking and killing the females in their colony. Mm-hmm. And this happens both in the field and in the lab. And so things go kind of crazy.
Yeah.
And so these are my youngest animals that I can still keep together that aren't brutalizing one another. And so I separate them. I'm going to bring another cage up.
Okay.
The spider is found under the bark of dead trees. And what you can see here is a big female with below and an adult male who is courting her from above.
And what species is this?
This is Delana cancerides. Okay. This is my social species. And so as they reach sexual maturity in the lab, it's really critical that I separate them into their own colonies. And you may have noticed that, or it may not be obvious, but what I do is I have plastic bark that I use so that they've got tight spaces because they live under the bark of dead trees. And so like they need...
Is that like acrylic? Something you can see through, right?
Yeah. So it's a clear, translucent plastic.
Gotcha.
Acrylic, excuse me. It really is acrylic that I Velcro about an inch from the edge. And this is perfect for an awful lot of huntsman spiders. That's part of the trick, but it depends on what species you have.
Yeah.
Other ones would just as soon be on bark pieces. Can you see her? This is a bummer.
Where is she? No, I don't see her.
Yeah, that's because this is a bow eye.
Ah. You can. Yeah, I have one of those as well. She really blends in with a cork bark.
They really blend in, but man, I am in love. So anyway.
And you pronounce that bow eye?
Yeah, heteropoda okay. Bow eye.
Yeah. Yeah, I was always, I think I pronounced it once in a video, Bowie, and people were like, no, that's not it. I was like, well.
Okay, so here is a young adult female.
Mm-hmm.
I don't. She's not quite mature.
This is a heteropoda bowie as well?
This is heteropoda bowie.
Okay.
And I've got to say, I think they're awesome. They are totally one of my favorite solitary species.
And they refer to that commonly as that's the lichen huntsman spider or something like that?
Yeah, I've seen that. Only the males are really resembling a lichen.
Oh, okay.
I'm going to go back to academia just for a moment to explain. So basically, am I taking too long explaining this?
Not at all.
Okay. Nobody knew what huntsmen were doing. You know, that people knew bits and pieces, and different people have studied them, especially systematics, but behavior, not a whole lot. And so I started collecting other Australian species because that's where I was doing my research, and then have been bought them from dealers, all of whom you know well, and raised different huntsmen in the lab. And it's a whole lot easier to study different aspects of their behavior. I'm particularly interested in mother-offspring behavior and kind of this dynamics leading into sociality. And the short end of it is that I have studied 41 different species, about 30 of them pretty well, where I've had breeding and been able to look at different aspects in the lab.
Okay.
And the short end is there are solitary species. I have discovered a number of other social, or what we're terming prolonged subsocial, huntsmen who have similar behavior, albeit not quite as social as the Delana cancerites from Australia. And so this is awesome. They're doing different things. They've got different biology. They've got, different behavior. And although they share many behaviors, they're all different. And so it has been a really interesting ride with these guys.
So when you were in Australia studying these, were you studying them in a lab, or were you actually going out and studying them in nature, or both?
Both. When I'm in Australia, kind of depending on what the question I'm after, we will sometimes, best grad student ever who does wonderful work is Eric Yip, who's now at the University of Pennsylvania. When Eric and I were working in Australia, we had a number of plots at, in the bush, where we knew that there were colonies, and we would go out at night and follow their behavior and look for more of them and look for alternative retreats in the field. So we were doing tons and tons of field work.
Okay.
Other times I am interested in primarily collecting in the field and getting the demographics or the composition of the groups in the field collecting, and I might travel more broadly. So most of my work has been in Canberra, New South Wales, where I was associated with the Australian National University, but I've also traveled all over kind of Southern Australia, and I love working in the field. So.
This may be a stupid question, but I'm going to ask it anyways. When you're studying huntsmen in the field, like you mentioned, people find these huntsman spiders in their bedrooms and in their cars. And, you know, I see pictures all the time on Facebook and stuff where people are like, oh my gosh, look at this huge huntsman I just found in Australia. Are you studying, like when you're studying them in the field, is it just out like in the wilderness, or do you study them in urban environments as well?
It kind of depends on what I'm doing. So most of the behavior, I have studied them in a lab in Australia, but ultimately I have to come home. Yeah. You know, there's a limit to how long I can be there. So most of the behavior work I do here in cages that are designed to minimize escape and easy feeding. And so in Australia, I might send out a plea through the biology listserv for the department and say, please, I'm collecting huntsmen. Please bring them to me. So people collect them from their bedroom. There is a species that is truly common, Isopidella pesleri, all over Canberra. I have almost never seen it in the wild because everybody gets it under their curtains in their house. So literally, it's more of a house spider. Yeah. And so I actually don't know a whole lot about what their retreats are like other than what they do here because they are so happy to be in homes.
All right. So what are you showing us here?
I'm showing you Delana cancerides with white behind.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So I would be remiss if I didn't ask this question while I had someone that's actually studied huntsmen in Australia. But there's a lot of sensationalism. There we go. I can speak English. Regarding the size that these huntsmen actually get in Australia. So I'm curious, what is actually like the max size that a huntsman, like the largest huntsman spider in Australia? Because I'm sure it's not as big as the side of a house. Like you've seen some photoshopped pictures online.
Yeah. My huntsmen are big. Probably the largest species might have a leg span like this. So okay. I mean, good sized animals, but I cannot believe the craziness. I see pictures where a woman wakes up and discovers hundreds of babies of huntsmen in her bedroom, except that the photo that they're showing of these baby huntsmen, I happen to know are about 4 to 5 weeks old.
Yeah.
And, you know, come on, guys. Huntsmen are really cool. They really can occasionally kill vertebrates. And, you know, they're big enough to do things, but the hype about things that don't seem that interesting to me. It's like it's on the web, so more and more stories like this. On the other hand, there was a really cool picture where they showed a nest box in Western Australia of some small marsupial, and they opened it up, and it was full of Delana cancerides, the social huntsman, and that was pretty exciting for them. There's nothing like 60 animals to come pouring out of something you've just opened.
Oh, wow.
And that's normal biology. That really happened. And so I'm interested in that. I'm less interested in a wowie zowie huntsman are so big.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I just want to say, I think everybody ought to have huntsmen for pets in terms of, you know, most of them live 2.5. The smaller species live about 2 years. Most of the large one easily live about 2.5 years. Occasionally you get one that lives 2, 3 or beyond, but 2.5 years for a fast growing active animal is awfully appealing in my opinion. And the diversity is quite nice. In some, if I could go off on something, I feel a whole lot better about keeping huntsman spiders because they're very prolific. They move around readily. It is very rare to have huntsmen that are just super rare found in an isolated spot. And so I feel fine about pet huntsmen around the country, and I'm happy to promote it. Tarantulas that are rare that are being over collected out of sites, I am way less comfortable with that.
I understand and agree with you on that topic.
Yeah. So in terms of pet keeping, mm-hmm. you guys are making mistakes not to have your own huntsman. That's what I say.
Yeah, I've got a Heteropoda, what'd you say it was, Bowie? And a Heteropoda David Bowie.
David Bowie. Both of those are outstanding. The David Bowie is awfully pretty. I'm a little more charmed with Bowie right now. And I don't have, my adult female Lunula just died, but those guys are super fast.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you want to see this. Maybe other people have boxes and boxes of babies.
Yeah.
That they are raising.
You know, the huntsmen are known for being very fast and a little skittish and erratic. Like, you know, anytime I've had to rehouse mine, it's always been a little stressful just because I never know exactly when they're going to bolt and which direction they're going to go. But it seems anytime I talk about them or show them on my channel or anything like that, one thing that people, it's a reason that they're hesitant to keep them as pets is because they're really unsure about the potency of their venom. Like they have, you know, there's so much misinformation out there online that people are really afraid that they have like this super strong, almost lethal venom. And, you know, and even doing my research, sometimes I have a hard time finding exactly, you know, very information that is clear about that. So could you tell us a little bit about maybe their venom?
Huntsman venom is really not notable as being particularly dangerous to humans at all. Really, there is like that much. The badge huntsmen of Australia are considered to have a relatively bad bite. I have been bitten many, many times. 12 times I've been bitten badly out of, you know, 20 years of actually handling spiders. And only four times it was actually a bad bite. And it got hot and it hurt for 4 days, and that was the end of this. This is out of lots and lots of bites.
Yeah.
The difference is, well, I mean, tarantulas have big fangs. Mm-hmm. Huntsmen are big enough to give you a good bite. And so that's something to think of. I don't really want to go off on the worst bite I ever got, but the worst bite I ever got from a huntsman, not an Australian huntsman, I was handling her when I was tired and I was moving her into a much larger breeding cage and I wasn't fast and she latched onto my thumb and was on my thumb for about 5 minutes. And, you know, anybody with any common sense would have just smashed her, but I had raised her from a baby and was really interested in her biology. And so I was using forceps to try to get her off and she was in no mood. She was, you know, biting me. And I called my husband and said, I'm in trouble. You got to come help me. I'm in trouble. And that was the only time where I really got a bad bite and it started spreading. But you know, most of the Delana you can actually hold if you're gentle. So I pick them up very readily. Most of the huntsmen are too fast to do that. What I do, which probably isn't going to work for most homeowners, is I use CO2 as an anesthetic and dope them. They're down for 3 to 5 minutes and I can just gently pick them up. The trick is because they've got scapula on their legs that hold on to, or, you know, effectively hold on to the glass, mm-hmm. whether they're awake or not, is you've got to be really careful to pick their legs up. Otherwise, I would probably chill them very briefly.
Yeah.
Try to slow them down. But CO2 is what I use when I need to. And some of it is just, you know, you're careful.
Right. Yeah. When it comes to the, like, taking care of them, because you've got a whole bunch of different species, it looks like there. Is the husbandry pretty much the same across the board? Or are there, like, more, you know, moisture-dependent species or?
Good question. It depends on where they're from. Okay. I've got desert animals. I've got The Australian huntsmen need to be kept relatively dry. The ones from Malaysia need to be kept relatively humid. What I do with everything is I have substrate in the bottom of my cages that I just pour distilled water into and maintain the humidity. That way they have water dishes in most of them. One of the things about huntsman spiders that really matters, you need to know whether they need tight spaces or not. Mm-hmm. Huntsmen really need a lot of air. And so what I do is I drill holes here and here and put screening on top. And then I buy, you can get it wherever you want. Mine are Pioneer plastic. And so I've got it tight and I've got cork holes so that I'm not opening the cages to feed them. Because with huntsmen, that's a mistake. And same thing.
So that's ventilation on the side and on the top. You've got like screen ventilation
for
there.
For bigger cages and for littler cages, I just have the air holes on the top.
And for the that's like a little feeding port. I think you were showing me this when we were in Virginia Beach. And you just kind of like melt a large hole in the side of the enclosure and then stick like a wine cork in there?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So that way you can just kind of drop in the feeders and not actually have to open up the entire enclosure.
Exactly. And so, you know, this cage is probably 5-10 years old. Yeah. And then, of course, animals, as they get larger, move into larger cages. And the nice thing about these is you can just take the top off and put it in something larger and then pull it out after they grow.
Yeah. And you were talking about some of the huntsman spiders need like tight spaces, and you were showing the acrylic or plastic, like the clear plastic you put in there, so they can have that feeling of being, you know, like hidden behind bark or something like that, but you can still see them. Like the fact that it's clear, that doesn't dissuade them at all from using it?
Not in the slightest. Huh. So you don't really see this here. I'm going to do this. And if I lose this animal, I'm going to be unhappy. But
she's taking the lid off the enclosure after we just talked about not taking the lid off.
So these are my huntsmen. And so what I've got them on is this clear piece of acrylic that I didn't clean well enough for this showing. And then I've got it Velcroed in with a strong Velcro. Mm-hmm. And these guys want to be in tight spaces. A bunch of them want to be in tight spaces. If you're working with David Bowie, and this is the only one that I know where there is no negotiating, they need leaves.
Yeah.
In the wild, they hang out under leaves. So you've got to set them up with lots of leaves that they will hang out underneath. And they also want some hard things like cork bark. And then, you know, most of mine are just set up on cork bark. So this is Heteropoda Okinawa. You can see the egg sac, but maybe not the mom. But I've put leaves in, and her youngsters are hanging out on leaves while mom is on the bark.
Nice.
So,
yeah, I've got my David Bowie in an arboreal enclosure. With cork bark, like a big piece of cork bark kind of going diagonally, and then a whole bunch of fake plants. And it usually just hanging out on top of a leaf, sometimes underneath. But it also spends a lot of time just on the side of the glass, which I thought was kind of interesting. I thought it would want more protection and hide more than just being like right out in the open.
They do it all.
Yeah.
You know, they're clearly active at night. I've gone out in Singapore looking for them. We didn't find a thing, but we found the right habitat. So.
Now, do you keep them?
I've been modeling after.
Do you keep them more on the more humid side, more moist?
More humid side.
Okay. Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. I've got a good water bowl in there and stuff, but
keep them up. And, you know, other people like cocoa fiber. I've had nothing but disasters with cocoa fiber. I really like Zilla Jungle Mix.
Yeah.
And so everybody's in Zilla Jungle Mix.
Yeah, the Zilla Jungle Mix, and I think it's a Zumeds Reptisoil. That's what I use a lot, because I was just having so many issues with mold and fungus in the cocoa fiber, and it was just dusty, and it was inexpensive at first, but it was like it just became such a reoccurring problem, And since I've switched to those, I have not had, and I think it looks nicer as well. It looks more natural.
I think it does too. At one point, probably 2 years ago, we had this killer fungus that moved in on, I had been using just potting soil, bad mistake, but I'd gotten away with it for years. And all of a sudden we had this fungus sweep, 50 cages that needed to get dealt with immediately before it killed the spiders, because it was killing spiders. So anyway, that's my husbandry bit.
I mean, the two that I have, like we said, the David Bowie and the Bowie seem to be some of the most common available, like in the pet trade. Like, are there any other species that I'm not aware of that are common for people to keep, at least here in the States?
Everything changes by who's collecting and where.
Yeah.
But to be perfectly honest, Heteropoda venatoria, which is, if I say invasive, you're going to think this is really bad, but found around the world, probably originated in Southeast Asia somewhere. Mm-hmm. And Heteropoda venatoria is a fantastic species. They're fast, they're active. One of the things that I like about cork holes is you can get some level of interaction where they're running around. You see activity. Mm-hmm. I like tarantulas, but a lot of tarantulas just sit, and I want something that moves. And so Heteropoda venatoria is a very nice one. Some of the oleo species from the American Southwest are fine. Frank Soma is promoting or has some Heteropoda maxima, which is the largest species that I think is going to end up being about so big.
Oh, wow. So for the people just listening, what would you say that's about, a 5-inch leg span or more?
Truth is, I don't know. I don't have any adults yet. I've got a lot of babies, but my beloved Bowies here, these guys have 8 to 9 inch leg spans. Some of it is how they hold their legs.
Yeah.
People are saying, well, how big is this baby? And well, the body isn't very much, but the leg span's like that on different animals.
Like my David Bowie looks kind of small when it's all like curled up, resting in the corner. But then when it goes out hunting, it those legs come out and I'm just like, whoa, you're much bigger than I realized.
This is silly. I'm relatively lean on other species right now.
Forgive my ignorance on the topic, but are all huntsman spiders in the genus Heteropoda, or are there other genuses that are huntsman spiders?
No. That's a good question, but definitely not. So we have been working on a phylogeny or a family tree of the huntsman. I and another colleague did one, and then we've just expanded it with the different animals that I've been working with from around the world in order to get a better idea of relationships, especially focusing on the Australian ones. There are 11 different subfamilies of huntsman spiders, often found in different parts of the world. So my Australian species are in the subfamily Delenidae, and all of the endemic species from Australia have a single origin. Heteropoda is a worldwide species and very, very speciose. Actually, one of my absolute favorite huntsman species are the Berylestes species, especially Berylestes scutatus, which is a smaller but a decent sized species. And Berylestes scutatus is from Cameroon. Lots of imports are coming in with these guys. They're fast. They're patterned, so they can be very camouflaged, but are quite active. So this is the genus Berylestes. So different subfamilies all over the place. And I believe there's about 11 of them. And then there are 89 different genera of huntsman spiders. And the genus is Heteropoda or Delena or Berylestes or whatever.
Okay. And is there a specific species that if somebody has kept tarantulas or, some other kind of arachnid, and they're interested in getting a huntsman spider, is there a particular species you think, is best for a beginner?
The oleo species are really slow compared to the others.
Okay.
So they might be nice for a beginner. For I want to be totally enchanted with Huntsman, I would go with a Heteropoda boei or a Heteropoda venatoria. Everybody loves David Bowie, but they're a quirky species. And I've got to say, I have never seen a species lay as many empty egg sacs.
Huh.
Boei lays empty egg sacs all the time. I mean, I would guess it's one viable sac to every eight that aren't viable. It's crazy.
Wow. Do you study, I mean, just looking behind you, there's all kinds of enclosures. It looks like, and you got like a tarantula photo on your, or like a what was it, like a painting, a tailless whip scorpion, a tarantula. So, I mean, are there other arachnids or inverts that you study there in your lab?
Yeah. So my passion are the Huntsman spiders, and mm-hmm. certainly the diversity have been Huntsman spiders. I love tarantulas. I really like tarantulas. I am interested in the tarantulas that live communally. These are the ones that really rattle my chain, basically, even though I have others because they're nice. The other group that I have actually studied are the amblypygids. And I've got to confess, although I have collected amblypygids in the wild, primarily or overwhelmingly my work has been in the lab. And I was interested in diversity of behavior in the amblypygids. So it turns out that Damon Diadema love to live in groups and stay together until the animals are almost a year old. Whereas you look at the other big group that I have here, Phrynis longipes from Puerto Rico, and they are willing to be around one another, but they don't interact. Whereas Damon Diadema is in one passionate whip exchange with one another.
So when you're saying amblypygids, you're just for the people listening, like tailless whip scorpions is the common.
Tailless whip scorpions is the common name, mm-hmm. or whip spiders is another common name. And I want to resist this. I want to strongly urge everybody to learn to say amblypygids because they're not spiders, although they're quite closely related to spiders. They're quite distant from scorpions.
Right before you came on the podcast, I was on the phone with a tarantula dealer, and we were talking about amblypygids. I just kept mispronouncing it because I do that a lot, and he was having a hard time with it as well. We're like, amblypygids.
I just had a little, a young adult male, I hope, come in. Here's a nice...
Whoa, he just took off.
Yeah, so the amblypygids are...
It's like they can sense what it is you want them to do, and then they do the exact opposite.
So there are species I would never, ever hold, and Damon Diadema is a love. But I have not held this one much. So with the Damon Diadema and with other amblypygids, what you can see is that they're closely related. Come on. Sorry. They're closely related to other arachnids with two body parts, eight legs. First leg is modified into a whip, and it essentially serves the function of antennae. In this particular species, man, it's been a while since I've thought about the numbers, but in this particular species, I believe there's on order of 152 joints in leg number one, so that her leg can move essentially entirely around her body.
Wow.
And they don't have great vision, so their whole life is centered on what information these whips can pick up. I have literally seen these guys stroking prey on the other side of something getting the prey to come up a cricket and then attacking it as it came around on the other side.
I've seen that as well. It's almost like they're like tapping them from behind to get them to come closer to their pinchers.
Absolutely. They are just really, really interesting animals. I have found them relatively hard to work with. Eileen Hebbett's lab has, or I'm interested in behavior. Eileen Hebbett's has looked at more of the neurobiology and what information they're picking up in the whips. And they've done better than I have. Partially because it's so hard to keep track of what they're doing. But if I had something else here, this animal would be moving its whip to pay attention to me.
Yeah.
And so I assume most of your folks are familiar with Ambla pigeons, but yeah. Man, I love Amblies.
Yes, they're very cool. But very secretive. Like I usually only see mine late at night. Like I got to come down, you know, after the sunset, everything's quieted down, usually around midnight, 1 a.m. It'll come out from behind its cork bark and be exploring its enclosure, doing some hunting.
So something to keep in mind is that Ambla pigeons also like tight spaces. So if you put the bark up against the glass or the plastic of its cage, you're much more likely to see them. This is a group that I can keep groups together for about a year. Mm-hmm. And so these guys are really interesting, if increasingly hard to get in the States, I believe.
I found it kind of frustrating when I was trying to do some research on them. Just because there seems the ones that are in the States, there's a lot of, at least in the pet hobby, I should clarify that they're misnamed, you know? So I think as somebody sells me a diadema and then it turns out to be a Midius or, you know, something like that. Yeah. And then trying to like find information where you can really identify and tell the different species apart from each other. It just doesn't seem like there's a whole lot that's readily available or easily found online. And that just from speaking to a few different people, it seems like there just hasn't been enough research done in the classifications of a lot of these different species. Why would you say that is?
Because they're really hard to work with, actually, because they are so secretive. Relatively few people have done research on them, even systematic and you know, even the systematics of Ambla pigeons, there has not been a huge amount of work. I can direct you to some things. Weigold has a good book. Mark Harvey from Australia has a wonderful list of all the Ambla pigeons and where they're from. But these are in book form.
Well, I got Frank Soma's phone number now, so I just call him.
Let him do that. Yeah, and I think Frank is really, really good with them. I'm going to put this animal down unless you want me to just hold it.
No, that's fine. But they're found all over the world, though, it seems like. They're here in the United States. There's some species here. They're in Africa. Are they in Australia as well?
Only one tiny species in a small area. They are quite uncommon in Australia. Found all over Africa, primarily pantropical distribution, so closer to the equator. But found all over the world. The ones that I think are really interesting and quite good work has been done on them is Brazil and other parts of Central America, or excuse me, South America, not Central America.
Yeah. A lot of times when I see them for sale online, or not even online so much as like at reptile expos and conventions and stuff, they don't even bother with the scientific name. They're just like, it's a tailless whip scorpion. We have no idea where it came from. Which can be kind of frustrating because, you know, then you don't know if they're communal or not communal or, and there's actually been a few, I think it was Alex from Tarantula Haven got some, species from some kind of reptile show that were misidentified. So he thought the species he got was communal and was keeping them communally. And then they ended up eating each other. So he was like left with like one or two and was pretty upset and then realized this wasn't the species I thought it was.
Yeah.
You were mentioning that there's a lot of the tarantulas that you're most interested in are the communal species. And I mentioned it when we were talking before, there's been a little bit of controversy around keeping some species of tarantulas communally, at least in the hobby, because there hasn't.
Tell me why.
Well, it seems like there hasn't been a whole lot of research that's been made available proving that some of these species can be successfully kept communally. Like Monas and Trophus balfouri is a species that's pretty much well known. Like you can keep those communally. But Neotheliensi, or you know, was one. I've seen people keep them communally successfully, but there's also been others that have attempted it and it's ended disastrously. So there seems to be a small section in at least the tarantula hobby that is like, it's not worth it. Don't try to keep any tarantula communally because, you know, it's not natural. But you've had a lot of success with many different species, it seems.
Yeah, I've had great success with many species. You know, I'm learning from you folks to a large extent. So it's clear that Histocrates gigas lives together and the young stay nearby. I have two 10-gallon tanks with that originally had lots and lots, and now it has fewer. And then I have separated them, and it's clear that they've just reached a point where a bunch of them are ready to go on walkabout and are getting aggressive with one another. So It's time to separate them. But I've had them together for, this must be 3 years now. About 15 years ago, I traded Trinidad chevron youngsters. Lots of Trinidad chevrons and lots of Brachypelma vagans have come out of my lab. So I traded Trinidads for 15 Neotheliensi from someone who I thought was pretty reputable. That was 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. I now have 12 colonies of these guys. They live together in groups beautifully. You can mix and match different group, different individuals, albeit they're related. And my students were interested in doing a study where it doesn't matter what the study was, but they pulled out a bunch individually just before the pandemic. Yeah. And since I was the one taking care of my entire lab with some assistance, I put them all back together and said, enough already. And it was like coming home from World War II. They said, we are ready to have babies. And so, you know, I probably have 6 or 7 egg sacs right now.
Wow.
And so I have always kept them together in groups, and they're delightful. They're one of my very favorites.
Are there any other species that you keep communally? Like Postlotheria is another one, like the Postlotheria metallica and regalis, I think. Recently, people have been having a lot of success, and that's starting to become more common and accepted, but there's always...
I think I watched one of your videos. Come on. And that's when I decided to do it. So I've got a group of Regalis youngsters and a group of Metallicas together right now that are just delightful. And it's clear that as they get older, you need to separate them. But I do that with Huntsman spiders. Not a problem.
So you just pulled up an enclosure here. It looks like Exoterra... What is that?
Yeah,
18 by 18 by 18?
I think it's a 12 by 12.
Okay.
And what's key is that I have bark along each of the sides so they can hide from one another. And I put a lot of food in. And although I open the door, I use cork holes for bloody everything if I can. And these guys have just thrived and have been together for, well, since they were babies.
Yeah.
And they're many months old now. I think they're 8 months old or nice. Older now. I also have 4 adults living together. Just you keep moving them into larger cages.
Yeah.
If they need the space.
And with the Imbalforia, have you had any experience introducing like you have an established communal and then introducing, you know, maybe 1 or 2 more into that communal or combining communals or anything like that? Or do you keep them pretty separate?
I was going to ask you for advice, honestly. So I have 4 different groups of young Balfouri right now. And my original idea was to possibly try moving them in and see what happened. But boy, they're hard to see. You know, It's not like they're coming out and saying, yeah, I'm here. But I think I'm going to mix them up and just see what happens and just give them a large enough container so that they can meet and become familiar with one another. Do you know otherwise?
I've heard mixed results because I have like a solitary female and I have a communal, and I was thinking about combining the two. Some people said they has been very successful. Others said that they had issues, especially between females that are full grown or near full grown, and kind of intermixing them. But if they were like spiderlings or juveniles, then they didn't have that problem. And it's just, it seems like it's so new. There's people have different experiences, and you never really know what exactly the situation was outside of just the fact that they were introducing these spiders together. You know, you don't know what the size of the enclosure was or anything like that.
Yeah. So with NC, my experience is that you can mix and match different groups without any qualms. I would try to avoid putting adult females together in a new group, but different ages should not be a problem. With Monocentropus, I have kept them as groups. And then as they started reaching adulthood, I would pull out the females and put males from the other group in. And so I mixed and matched. But I just want to say, when you're thinking about social spiders generally, with the most social of the spiders, which are species of cobweb spiders and species of Stegodyphus, which is a velvet spider. I don't have another name for it. But these guys, you can mix and match between colonies without much problem. I can mix and match individuals of my social huntsmen if they are young, but as they get closer to adulthood, there are more and more problems and much more serious attacks that you're going to get. Applying that to my experience with the communal spiders, I would never put adult females together who were unrelated. I might even be hesitant if they were separate and related, but had not been living together, together of the females. But in terms of the juveniles, I can't give anybody the ultimate word. But my take is that we can probably do it and do it okay. With the Histocrates that have been studied, Sam Marshall has done some work on them. And I've owned Histocrates for, 25, 30 years. And I would not mix unrelated animals other than males in, I'm willing to move males between every cage and please do your job. I'm interested in babies. I'm interested in what happens when the animals are young.
Yeah. It's a part of arachnid or spider behavior that I've kind of found interesting, because it seems like, with my geckos or reptiles and amphibians, it's usually the males that get very territorial and you have to separate from enclosures that are communal. But when it comes to spiders, it seems like it's usually the females that kind of get aggressive with each other. Do males?
I think more so.
Yeah.
With the prolonged subsocial huntsmen, the males are perfectly willing to fight one another, but they're willing to live with each other as well. Every sex is testy with the same sex, is my experience, once they reach a certain age. But my sense is that males can be moved around more readily in the spiders.
Yeah.
And honestly, they're male spiders. You can move them around and they will make it or they won't make it.
Yeah. Have you had any breeding in your Imbalfori communal? Are they not that age yet?
I have been trying and have mated animals that have been isolated for about 6 months. I have seen egg sacs without successful young. And I just got my first clutch that really are out and are doing well.
Yeah. That was clutch. Was that done in isolation or in the communal?
What Tanya Stewart told me is to separate them. Yeah. So what I've done is I have 6 or 8 Monocentropus balfouri females alone, and I sometimes toss males in there for a while and pull them out. But the feeling is that the males are just too distracting.
Yeah. That's something that seems to be coming up a lot, at least in different, there's actually on Facebook an Imbalfori communal group, and that's all they discuss in there. is, you know, keeping the Socotra Island blue baboon in communal. And that was one thing they were saying is very rarely do they have success, successful egg sacs from breeding in the communal. But if they separate them out and breed them in isolation, then everything seems to go well. So I thought that was kind of an interesting behavior.
Yeah.
Like, I wonder why they wouldn't breed in a communal like that.
Maybe it's just so disruptive. And I've got to say, Monocentropus just has hit my fancy. And I'm saying this, I think, not as an academic, but saying it as just somebody who likes spiders, is they do the weirdest things. I have never seen tarantulas piling on top of one another like they're in a sardine can like this. I mean, they're just crazy.
Yeah. And they do some beautiful webbing. Like, that's one of my favorite parts about, especially keeping them in a communal, just how many tunnels and how intricate the whole thing becomes. It's very exciting to watch. Now,
you like tunnels. You need INSEE. You need Neoholothelia INSEE.
Yeah, that's a communal I've always been a little cautious about. I'm glad to hear that you've been having so much success, because my exposure to it has been very limited. But I think there's like two or three guys that I saw on YouTube that tried to keep them communally, and it went bad, and they ended up separating them back out and like lost half of them. But I saw, when I was in Virginia Beach, Tanya was having a lot of success with her communal there.
They came for me. But yeah, you know, I think I have enough to populate the U.S. with Neoholothelia right now.
I might have to hit you up, because I think I've only got one right now. One little individual hanging out.
You know, literally, they've just been fantastic. And they're breeding faster than I can keep up. They're eating a lot of crickets. So now,
there's two different color forms of those, right?
What I have always had the natural form.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden we're starting to get some gold mixed in. And then we kind of lose the gold and go back to the natural. What Frank Soma has told me is that he thinks it's a mutation. You can't blame Frank for this.
Yeah.
That's my understanding of it. Are you interested in seeing my Neoholothelia, or is it just too hard to show?
No, yeah, definitely. Bring him up on camera. If it's not, I don't know how difficult it would be for you.
It's which one I should bring.
Oh my goodness.
I don't know that you're, I.
That's a lot of webbing.
Yeah, they have a lot of webbing. And by definition, my picking them up, you're not going to.
Oh yeah, they all go into hiding. How many would you say is in there?
They have tunnels that they live in.
Yeah.
All over the place. And then under the bark. So that wasn't coherent. Basically, what you need to do is give them cork bark and coconut shells. Mm-hmm. And they can build very nice retreats under the coconut shells, and then gives them something so that they can climb up the walls of the cage. And I don't know if you can see it here, but there's babies all along the edge.
Yeah, you can see those.
I tend to have periods of walkabout when they're kind of mid-adolescence and a new clutch has been born.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
So when you're,
I have lots of animals in every cage.
So when you're keeping them communally like that, and they have an egg sac, like those are babies, just kind of, do you separate the young from there, or do you just leave them in the communal and let them grow? Nice. I've been having that issue. I've got a Florida bark scorpion communal, and they are prolific breeders. So it seems like every other month I've got at least one female with a clutch on her back, or a brood. And if I separate her out, and then once they leave her back, put them in their own enclosures and, you know, let them get to a more, you know, closer to adult sized, and then reintroduce them in the communal, no problems. But if I just leave her in there with them, they all seem to disappear before they reach juvenile. Like, they just become snacks or something. So I didn't know if that was the same with tarantulas.
I think that what's happening is they need their own tunnel and their own retreat.
Yeah.
In my cages, the mid-adolescents tend to start moving up along the rim. And if you've got things that they can attach webbing to, they're happy and do great. And so it's clear that if I was moving animals out, I could start more colonies, but there is a limit to how much of my space is going to go to Neoholothele insei in my lab. And I mean, literally we have 12 colonies right now.
That's pretty impressive. Yeah.
I like them.
Yeah. Do you study or keep any scorpions in your lab?
I have scorpions for outreach to show them. And, you know, I like Heterometris and the emperor scorpions just because you can keep them in groups.
Yeah.
And so I have those, but I'm not studying them.
Now, when you say outreach, what exactly do you do as far as outreach is concerned?
Lots of outreach. So I think that probably the best thing that I will do in my career is that I am training young scientists how to talk to the public about big science issues, but in ways that are appealing and understandable.
Okay.
And so I have a class where I am training students how to do effective outreach, and then my college students go out into the community and give talks at schools or in community groups. But in addition, they're doing more and more things online. I think of some of the best things that I've done in my career overall are outreach at different forms. So I give lots of talks to the public about spiders.
When you say you give talks to the public, like what does that venue look like? Like where are you going and talking to people?
I generally talk to larger groups. So I mean it might be a pub where they have science cafes. It might be a group hosted by a university with 300 or more people. I think it's wherever people want to hear me talk about spiders.
They're almost just like a group of scientists are like, oh, we're going to get together and share our research and ideas. Or is it like open to the public?
It's open to the public. I mean, I give science talks that I'm not telling you about that. I'm telling about talking to the public. So I was a keynote speaker at Invertebrates. It's the Invertebrates in Captivity Conference. Invertebrates in Education and Conservation Conference a few years ago. And that was lovely. I give talks in Australia. I give talks where people invite me and pay my way. You know, I've talked everywhere here. You know, I've talked to summer visitors at Cornell. So I give lots of public talks to people. But, you know, I'm reaching maybe 300 people at a time. And so something like Monster Bug Wars or the naturalist outreach videos give me an opportunity to hit a much wider audience. And so the way I think of Monster Bug Wars was that was really big time outreach. And Discovery Channel, when they commissioned it, their idea was that they were going to get the 18 to 35 year old men with money who would be interested in this. And that actually isn't the demographic that fell in love with Monster Bug Wars. It was the 5 to 12 year old set who went crazy. And so I hope that I have managed to connect with a new generation who are interested in the behavior of arthropods. So for me, that's outreach. And I must say they ended up, the money I earned from doing that paid for my research in Australia for 2 seasons.
Nice. I think that was the first time I was introduced to you was watching Monster Bug Wars. You could definitely tell, like I'm always conflicted watching shows like that because sometimes it feels like they're trying to maybe sensationalize a little bit of the, I don't want to say danger, but you know, like I was watching one about a scorpion versus the pirate spider, I think, you know, and sometimes it gets a little over dramatic, but I mean, I guess that's just that type of show.
I think, you know, I have the same ambivalence about it. But I think a number of things made Monster Bug Wars really appealing and good. One, the photography is out of sight. They yeah. did an amazing job with the photography. The other thing is that the producers and the writers were really good with me. And I basically refused to say something that I thought wasn't true and would check their biology. And so they were very interested in getting the biology right, even if there was more drama.
Yeah.
So they always wanted me to give bigger, you know, and the size of those chelicera. And you know, at some level, I was willing to do that. But mm-hmm. this is something that I try to teach my own students is you've got to be true to yourself. And so on Monster Bug Wars, I was only willing to say what I believed to be true, as opposed to what the writers would have loved to have me say.
Yeah.
And yes, the sound effects in season one were just appalling. But you know, the photography was great. The biology was good. And if this is enough to get people excited about arthropods, I'm all in. I think this really matters. And so I see this as big time outreach. I'm going to talk about me a little bit longer. But at the end of 2016, I got a totally random email from the Australian Museum in Sydney asking me if I would be willing to be a consultant on an exhibit that they had. They already had a very nice spider exhibit, Spiders Alive and Deadly, but they were aware that they wanted to move it to North America and that they weren't sure that it was North American enough, that it was American enough. Mm-hmm. And they were clear that there were some things that just weren't quite as good as they thought they could be. And so out of the blue, they hired me. And what they didn't realize is that I had been teaching and thinking about how to do good exhibits for years. And so I was enthralled. And they said, well, we'll send you the signs. And I said, no, I'm going to be in Australia. So we moved to Sydney for a while during our last sabbatic. And I worked at the museum and helped rewrite some of the exhibit. And then in a period of absolute craziness, my students and I prepared dried specimens of live spiders so that they looked lifelike enough to be able to walk off the display case of North American spiders. And then I've been organizing the spiders and designing the cages for the museum exhibit. So far, it's only opened in Toronto at the Royal Ontario Museum and at the Montreal Science Center. I just heard rumors that another museum in the U.S. has signed for it, and I hope more will. And it was this amazing, just absolute. There have been other spider exhibits in the U.S., and this is, even if I wasn't involved, it's the best exhibit I've ever seen on spiders. And it was just so appealing. It was just thrilling to be part of it. And so, you know, this wasn't my exhibit, but I have contributed to a lot of different pieces. Yeah. And so the 300,000 people that saw it between these two museums, I hope I got a lot of people to like spiders.
Definitely. Yeah, I mean, that's one of the, I think a lot of the fear that people have for spiders and arachnids in general is just born out of ignorance. Like they're afraid of the unknown. And, you know, the more they learn about, I mean, that was the case for me. I was terrified of spiders. The more I learned about them, the more fascinated I became, and the you know, my fear just kept getting smaller and smaller. And now it's just, I'm just full blown in love with them, I guess. Continually fascinated by them. Mm-hmm. You know, even just, I mean, like just while we, you know, we were getting everything set up here for the podcast, like I just turn around and can just, you know, spend probably way too much time just staring at all the different inverts and watching them walk around and do their thing.
Yeah.
Just fascinating.
Well, you've certainly seen me some of it's thinking and some of it's saying, oh, what animal am I going to pull forward? Because they're right here around me.
Yeah. And that's why I think it's cool, you know, that you're willing to come on this podcast. And, you know, that's why I do what I do. And part of the reason that I got into making YouTube videos is from watching Monster Bug Wars and some other, like, you know, nature documentary style shows that were focusing, even if it just like briefly in one episode, were focusing on a scorpion or a tarantula or a spider and being and really enjoying it, but wishing there was more, you know, like it's nothing worse than watching a David Attenborough documentary and they talk about a tarantula for 60 seconds and then they move on. And it's like, no, I wanted more of that content. And so it's like, well, I got to learn how to do this and do it myself. And it's shows like Monster Bug Wars where I, you know, kind of used as inspiration to be like, I want to film like that. So what kind of cameras and lenses are they using and how are they doing that? You know, and I try my best to kind of emulate that, but I don't know. I feel like that's one of the best venues to kind of change people's hearts and minds is educating them. And like when I had Coyote Peterson on the podcast, he sometimes is controversial, at least in the pet hobby or the pet hobby. Coyote Peterson, he's a YouTuber. He's probably got like 3 or 4 million followers. He kind of got big after Steve Irwin had passed away. I don't know if that's true or not, but it was around that kind of time frame. Steve Irwin was a big, and he kind of had some of, and I don't want to speak for him, but it seems his philosophy on education is similar to Steve Irwin's. And like, you know, yeah, I like his big thing is, he gets bit or stung, you know, by, you know, whether it's a snapping turtle or a scorpion or something like that. But it's like my kid loves it, you know, because there's drama. You know, the video starts out with them like, oh, I'm entering the bite zone or whatever, and holds the spider up and it bites them. But then they cut off right before the bite and they don't show that until the end of the video. Well, everything in between those, like, you know, is split up 30 seconds in the beginning, 30 seconds at the end. But the other 12 minutes of the video is all just education about the species, conservation, you know. So it's like my kid is watching because he wants to see the guy get stung by a scorpion, but he actually ends up learning a whole lot, you know. And like, even though that's the sensationalized part, it is very successful in drawing people in and them learning. So it's, you know, it's kind of like a two-edged sword or a bittersweet aspect where it's like, yeah, you maybe shouldn't be doing that. That seems irresponsible, but also you're really kind of lighting this fire in kids and getting them interested in these species. Yeah.
When I give public talks, I almost never talk about spider venom. And because the big deal isn't that they bite people. What I am talking about more now is how much spider venoms have potential to do good.
Yeah.
I've given you the Arachnophilia Passion for Spiders website, which was an exhibit that I did several years ago here at Cornell. Not that one, but the Arachnophilia website. And in that, we really emphasized how venom is doing a lot of good in a way that I don't really want to talk about how dangerous spiders are.
I understand.
You know, I would rather not get bitten by things or stung by things.
Yeah.
You know, it happens and you'd rather it wouldn't. You know, I'm a field biologist and I'm a woman. I am a female field biologist. And the riskiest thing that I do is be in the field alone. And that's because I'm a woman. And it's not from the snakes. It's not from the spiders. It's from men. And so this is something that affects me and every other female field biologist.
Yeah.
And yet at the same time, I'm way more nervous about snakes. I mean, I can remember being in a place where I am debating, do I move 3 feet forward through this tall grass toward this tree where I can catch that huntsman spider, or do I just stay where I am in the open grass and not risk the snakes? You know, I think it's a trade-off. So being a field biologist is intrinsically risky, I think, in a lot of ways, even just having this many spiders in my lab. Yeah, I just got a really bad bite last spring, and I wish it hadn't happened. But I worked with them for a long time and nothing has happened otherwise. And yet the sheer joy of being outside where, you know, you see this beautiful morpho butterfly fly by as you're watching. You know, some of being a biologist is boring as all get out. And, you know, you're just sitting there waiting for things. Or if you're in the lab, you're taking care of crickets. Who knew that part of my life was going to be taking care of crickets or for that matter, handling big spiders. But just the sheer joy of being outside and discovering new things is worth so much. And so I have loved being a biologist.
Yeah, I can imagine. I can tell just by listening to you talk. That's probably the most asked question I get. I mean, from people in the hobby and just like anytime I do any kind of, you know, podcast or even just have a conversation with somebody that's outside of the hobby, usually one of the first questions they ask is, how many times have you been bit? And they're always extremely disappointing when I say I've never been bit. Like, I got my first tarantula.
How many times have you been bitten?
0 times. I got my first tarantula 21 years ago, and I've not been bit or stung as of yet.
I am really careful.
Probably smart.
And, you know, I do not want my students to get bitten by venomous things.
Right.
And I have a lab full of pokes.
Yeah. I mean, I've got a 12-year-old, and he's, you know, very respectful of the tarantulas. He's fascinated by them and the snakes and stuff like that. But that's kind of a line that we've, like, just me and my wife have kind of drawn is extremely hot species. Some of them I just don't keep it. Like, we don't have any venomous snakes at all. I've got a few scorpions that are pretty hot, but I've got them like in their enclosure inside of another secure enclosure. So it really minimizes the risk of escape, you know? So I do what I can to make things as safe as possible. But yeah, people always get disappointed when they're like, I was on a podcast, it was like a local artist podcast here in West Virginia. And that was like, that's what they wanted to hear about, were the crazy stories about being bit. And I'm like, it's never happened. I'm sorry. I got no crazy stories for you. For the most part, tarantulas are they're almost boring. Like, you know, they don't move around a whole lot. Like, they're beautiful to look at, but yeah, they're not crazy. So yeah, it's one of those things that people, I don't know, maybe it's just because they're scared of spiders. So they assume that they're these big, terrible, horrible things. And, you know, seeing pictures of huntsmen's the size of garbage can lids on Facebook does not help that at all.
And you know what the answer to that one is, don't you?
What's that?
Deli cups. Deli cups is what you need. I have given talks to neighborhood groups in Australia because I think it's really important to talk about what I'm doing. And, you know, the truth is, you're scared of a huntsman in your house. What you need is a deli cup and take it outside.
Yeah.
It's that simple.
Sometimes I actually tried to use I was moving around a Theraphosa sturmi. She's almost full grown, not quite there, but she's getting pretty big, but she outgrew the deli cup. And I didn't realize, like, she had molted. And I was like, oh, she's looking beautiful. She's hardened up. I'm going to take her out and get some photos of her under the lights. And She walked into the deli cup, but then once she got out on the table and like really kind of stretched out, I realized this deli cup is not going to capture her. I need to go get a big, you know, big thing at Tupperware or something, because if she takes off, I'm not going to be able to do anything.
Yeah.
But yeah, that is a very effective manner of wrangling tarantulas and other spiders. You mentioned that you are the president-elect of the American Arachnology Society. Did I say that correctly?
I am indeed.
Can you tell us a little bit about what that society is and what they do?
So the American Arachnology Society is the premier arachnology society for North America, certainly. And we have many, many members in Central and South America, but it actually has quite a worldwide membership. The American Arachnology Society runs the Journal of Arachnology, which is research published on spiders and other arachnids, and is the premier journal that is specifically dedicated to spiders. In fact, there's spider research published in all over the place. But this is the one dedicated to spiders and is the only one in the world of this level. We've got quite a large membership from around the world, and we coordinate with other international societies and other societies like from Europe. And this is the society that hosts the American Arachnology meetings in the summers. And we have made a point of, although this is primarily academics, we are perfectly happy for people who are interested in spiders or arachnids and want to know more to attend the meetings and certainly to attend our public talks. We also host a public outreach day associated with the meetings, and I'm on an outreach committee where we're trying to get together lists of some of the great books on spiders, educational games, this sort of things about arachnids onto the website. So everybody really ought to take a look at the American Arachnology Society website, particularly in resources. I think for this audience would find that the most valuable.
And how do you find out when these presentations or conventions are taking place? Is that just always on the website?
Look on the website.
Okay.
Look on the website. I literally do not know when it is next summer.
Yeah. That would be interesting.
But I hope it's not when I am leading the tour to Borneo. So.
I think it was not last summer. Maybe it was two or three years ago. I remember seeing someone post something about attending it. And I didn't even know that was a thing that existed. I knew about the American Tarantula Society, but they weren't really doing much of anything. And at the time, it seemed, at least that I was aware of. But when I learned about that, I was like, that might be interesting to go check out. But I wasn't sure if it was open to the public. It was just for researchers. It was just like an academic thing. You had to be invited.
It is open
to
the public.
Okay.
It is primarily academic, but it is open to the public. And we definitely have public-facing events of the meeting. Something else for those of you who are on the East Coast or closer to New York is every year, but this year, years ago, I organized Insectapalooza. And so the Department of Entomology here has a one-day insect festival dominated by my spiders in one of the rooms where we'll have like 35 different exhibits and very aimed for the public of all ages. There are different insect festivals around the country. Purdue has a great one. University of Pennsylvania has a good one. The point is that there are more and more insect festivals, which really are arthropod festivals because spiders are so cool, all over the place. University of Arizona has a great one. Nice. So I think no matter what level you're at, there are different opportunities open to you. And again, probably the place to look is the American Arachnology Society resource page, which is the last of the pages. And we've got lots of stuff like that on there.
Very cool. I mean, now, you know, you're the president-elect of the American Arachnology Society, and you do the Insect Palooza. Maybe I could sweet talk you into getting me a press pass or something so I can come out and cover one of those events, make some videos.
Yeah, absolutely. Not an issue.
That would be interesting.
And I think on the meetings, I actually don't remember how much we paid because the last couple of years it's been virtual. But so the last couple of years it's cost $20 to attend the virtual meetings.
Oh, wow.
In person is a little bit pricier, but none of this is that expensive if you want to learn more about arachnids.
Yeah, that would be very
and
cool.
Again, the public facing, you're not registering for the meetings.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I when I was first looking into it, I was worried it would just be like way above my head, that it would all just be scientific terminology. Like, I mean, sometimes reading the research papers that come out, you know, especially like when they're researching different tarantulas, you're reading it and sometimes you're like, I have no idea what they're saying. It gets a little,
you know, the writing is intended to be concise and specific for the field. I don't understand molecular biology papers, even though I have collaborated on this paper on the phylogeny of huntsmen, the systematists are the ones who wrote about that end. And then I wrote about my end. And I think you present things very, very differently for the public. I'm much more likely when I'm talking to the public, you tell the story first and the big issues first, and then you get into minutiae, whereas scientists tend to start with minutiae and then get to the big picture at the end. It's just kind of how you do it. Yeah. And so thinking that you can't read the papers is very different than following talks or looking at posters.
Yeah.
And what venue it is. But I think I'm not even going to go there. There's increasing support for interaction between the different members of the populace, all of whom are into spiders.
Yeah. So is the academic or scientific community, I mean, are they willing to accept people that are mainly just keep them as pets? Like, it seemed like for a while there was a, not so much like a conflict, but there was, there was like the scientific community and then there were the people that kept them as pets. And there wasn't many bridges that kind of, you know, went back and forth.
I think that's true.
I mean, is that changing? Do you think they're becoming more open?
I think, yes, I think it's more open. I have spent my entire career trying to bridge that, both in terms of what people keep as pets and overall appreciation. I think if there is any time that people ought to be paying attention to science and believe science, the time is now.
Definitely.
And that, therefore, scientists need to be able to communicate with the public. If we cannot convince the public through impassioned pleas that it makes sense to get a vaccination so you don't die, that the climate is changing, that the environment is at risk, that it's important to understand science, and it is absolutely impingent on scientists to bridge that gap and reach out to the public. At the same time, one hopes that the public is open to hearing information mm-hmm. and believing science. I don't think you need to accept that everything that is said in the name of science is the truth, because there isn't any the truth. But the point is you need to be open to understanding the world. And to some extent, we can help the public understand the world better. And so literally my entire career has been based on bridging that gap so that scientists can talk to the public and the public can understand what we're saying.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of one of the goals of what I am doing is trying to like, and one of the previous guests that I had on my podcast, she's a doctoral candidate, or she's a student at, I'm going to get the wrong, she has been to so many universities. I think it's the University of Colorado or Colorado University. I know she's in Colorado and she's in a doctoral program. And she gave me a tip that was like, just read like the abstract, or like the first couple paragraphs of the scientific paper, and then go to the end and read the conclusion. And that'll give you a much...
that'll give you the idea.
Yeah. Like you kind of get through, you skip over the minutia of it. Mm. And, you know, then maybe you go back and read the middle if you want more clarification, which helped me a lot. But like I try to take, like anytime I'm doing a video on a species, like I try to read those papers, pull what information I can from there and other resources, and then package it in a 10-minute video that is going to be entertaining for people that is also educational, you know? So they're like, and doing podcasts like this with you, you know, it's like,
yeah,
we're talking about the scientific stuff, which normally people would, you know, they would be like, oh, that's boring. I don't want to read about it or whatever, but we're doing it in a podcast kind of format where they, you know, driving to work or something like that. They can put it on, listen, be entertained and learn, you know, and it's they don't have to sit down and read a scientific paper to get that information, because people seem to respond better to hearing someone's experience, like personal experience, and relaying information that way than, you know, reading, you know, a book or something.
So one of the things, sorry about
what was that.
That when I opened the cages, some flies got out. And so I've got house fly flying around being totally annoying.
It would have been much cooler if it was a spider.
With my outreach students right now, who are biologists in a broad range of different fields. Some of them are aiming to go into teaching. But what I am teaching them now is that by giving a personal introduction and having the audience see you as a person with interesting opinions and perspectives, the audience is much more likely to listen to what you say and be engaged. And so really personalizing it makes all the difference in the world. So you heard my personal introduction, which is how I met and married my husband.
Yeah. And having met both of you, like, my wife still talks about you and your husband. She was very enamored with both of you all and really enjoyed the conversation.
Good, good. So she didn't really talk that much to me, but she did talk a lot to my husband, who was my husband, on the other hand, was very happy to have left this experience. And I mean, we were at Fear Not for a lot of time that day and other days. And he is so proud of being able to say GBB.
Chromatopelma cyanopubescence.
Nice. Green bottle blue.
Yeah.
He is so proud of himself. It's kind of, now he's hip.
Nice.
With the tarantula folks.
Awesome. That was a fun time. It was a little overwhelming. I did not anticipate that many people would be showing up, but yeah, it was.
I don't think anybody cool. did.
Was totally not prepared for that. It was really cool meeting you and your husband, and we didn't get to talk a whole lot there because it was so crazy, but.
And it was really interesting because the people who were talking to me were people who wanted to find out about a career in arachnology. Nobody talked to me about monster bug wars. Nobody talked to me about spiders, which was actually kind of a bummer. What they wanted to talk about was, what do you do if you want to become an arachnologist?
Yeah. I mean, that's information I wish I had when I was younger. Like, when I was in college and was just taking classes, trying to figure, I was like, am I going to be a music major? Am I going to be a business major? Am I going to be an environmental scientist? Yeah. You know, I was like, arachnology, I had a tarantula in my dorm room, you know, and I was fascinated by it, but I didn't even know arachnologist was a job description. You know, I didn't think that was an area of study that you could have. So, I mean, had I known that, my life may have been much different. But
yeah, I think a lot of people are looking around for careers. And just because you like spiders doesn't mean you want to spend a career associated with them.
Yeah, that's very true. But it seems like it's a field that's really starting to kind of open up, especially with the pharmaceutical research going into venom and, you know, just arachnids in general.
Or the silk research.
Yeah, I was reading an article about that recently. And they were looking at spider webs for, like, to replace stitches or something like that, like some kind of wound care. I was like, well, that's pretty interesting.
Because
rope and all other kinds of stuff.
It's very, very sterile. It has antibiotic properties and it's strong and stretches, and giving that little bit of extra give, and it will dissolve. So you don't need to go in and take it out.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting stuff. And just, you know, I mean, don't get me wrong. I love what I do. I feel very blessed that I've been able to make somewhat of a living filming and photographing tarantulas and scorpions. Like, I think that's pretty lucky to be able to do that. But it would have been, I would have appreciated having more of a scientific background when it came to that kind of stuff. If for no other reason than to just correctly pronounce scientific names. That's where I struggle the most. But I'm excited to hear that those conferences for the American Arachnology Society do have some public facing, because I would really like to go
absolutely.
And see that.
And you know, Insectapalooza has public face, is for the public. I think more and more people are trying to bridge that gap.
So when's the next Insectapalooza? Have you figured that out yet? Or is it still kind of up in the air?
End of October next year.
Next year?
End of October, a year from now.
And,
vaccinations, folks. Vaccinations.
Yeah, please. I was telling somebody the other day, I was like, I've gone back, even though I'm fully vaccinated, I've gone back to wearing my mask anytime I go outside. But it wasn't for like even a political or health reason. It was more, I realized I don't have to comb my beard if I wear masks. So I'm like, I don't have to comb it. I'll just put a mask on and it'll be good. I might just wear a mask the rest of my life when I'm out in public.
Well, we need to at Cornell. I had students not come in this afternoon since I knew I'd be filming in here.
Well, I appreciate you coming on.
Sure.
And I've got your websites. They scrolled periodically across the bottom of the screen. But I'll also have them listed down below in the description of the show notes for the podcast if people want to find out more information. Oh,
for a note, if anyone who hears this is interested in the big spider exhibit, they should contact me and I will direct them to the right people.
Okay. And how do they contact you?
Evergreen Exhibits has it.
Okay.
And it's Spiders from Fear to Fascination.
I will be sure to try to get that information from you. And I'll get all those websites listed down below in the comment section or in the show notes of the video. Thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate it. Sure. And if you guys are...
And seriously, if you want NC, I got NC.
Okay.
You just cover the shipping and I will send them to you. Not an issue.
That sounds like a good deal. I think it'd be fun to have an NC communal down here. And would make for some good content and interesting videos.
Yeah. All right. No, they're lovely. So, okay. See you later.
All right. Thank you. Goodbye.
Thanks. Goodbye.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this conversation. I did. I enjoyed being part of it. So hopefully you enjoyed listening to it. If you did and you're watching the video version of this on YouTube, please be sure to leave a comment down below and let me know what you thought or any questions you might have. Check the show notes or the description. There will be links to everything that we discussed in the podcast. I've got all of Dr. Rayer's information and anything that she said to check out. I'll have that link down below. If you're following me on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or anything like that, leave a 5-star rating, share it with your friends, anything you can do to kind of help feed that algorithm. I know on Apple Podcasts, leaving a 5-star review really kind of helps it, move up in the rankings and get suggested to more people. But honestly, I don't know how the whole podcast algorithm thing works so far. I've been focused mainly on Instagram and YouTube, but trying to figure it out. So if you don't mind, you could do that. That would help a lot. But other than that, guys, thank you all so much for listening. And I'll be back next Thursday or the Thursday after with a new podcast. There's a lot of guests I got lined up. So yeah, I hope you enjoy this and I hope you stick around and listen to another episode. But until then, I will see you next time.